Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everyone. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. Thank you very much for taking time this afternoon to join us live for another edition of Midrats. Or if you're with us on the podcast, we really appreciate you subscribing and checking in with us with our new shows. If you're with us live, we're trying to make it work, but usually we have at the bottom of the show page a chat room you can join that is a place where you can share your observations, or if in the course of the program there's a question you would like for us to address to our guest, that's a great place to put it. We'll do our best to fold it into the conversation as we go forward. And if you have to leave sometime during the course of the show and you want to catch up on what you missed, remember, all you got to do is subscribe to the free podcast on iTunes or any of the other aggregators, and it'll be there waiting for you shortly after the show ends. And let's go ahead and plow into today's show. And we talk about all things maritime, but we try to get a little bit of a joint credit now and then. So today we're going to shift over to talk about some of the things that those on the maritime side of the house should be aware of, a common topic here on Midrats. That's the intellectual development and education of our leadership. And we're going to look today at how the U.S. Army, and maybe a little bit on the joint side as well, help officers understand not just doctrine, but history and theory, to make sure that when we put those majors and above into staff positions, that the commanders have in their staff people that can help take direction and guidance, commander's intent, and put that into a usable, understandable, and functional plan. Whether they're very complex operations or just part of small operations, good military operations do not happen by accident, and they don't happen with a lot of hard intellectual work. And to address these questions and related topics, our guest today is going to be Colonel Kirk Dorr, United States Army. He is the director of the U.S. Army's School of Advanced Military Studies, commonly known as SAMS, over at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. He's a career armor officer and has commanded formations up to the company to grade levels and served in staff officer assignments up to the Army staff and joint staff levels. His military education includes attendance at both Harvard and Massachusetts Institute of Technology as a resident fellow studying international affairs and security studies. He also is a graduate of the School of Advanced Military Studies, Joint and Combined Warfighting School, and the Army's Command and General Staff College. And Colonel Dorr is joining us today, and his opinions are his own. He's not here to represent the United States Army directly or any other organizations he might be associated with. Kirk, welcome to Midrats.
Hey, Sal, it's great to be with you. I'm excited about the dialogue today and appreciate the invitation. By the way, I am a joint qualified officer, just throwing that out there, Sal, so I can supposedly talk.
Well, remember, it's a bulkhead of the wall and a hallway is a feeway. The rest is just gravy from there.
Hey, no, that's awesome. I appreciate the kind introduction, Sal.
Yes, sir. Glad to. Hey, being that the balance of our regular listenership has a little bit of a maritime flavor to it one way or another, I thought I wanted to kick off the show to give you an opportunity to give the listener an opportunity to get a better view of the constellation of schools, not just that the U.S. Army runs, but maybe even the joint flavor, that they may not have a full appreciation of. Because on the Navy side of the house, we tend to talk about the Navy Postgraduate School out in Monterey, the Naval War College up in Newport, and then it gets real quiet all of a sudden. And one of the great things that I enjoyed for the second half of my career is I got a better respect for the, as I use the phrase, there's a constellation of schools and professional development that the Army does with its officers that's different and worthy of consideration for those that are just familiar on the Navy side of the house. So why don't you give us an overview of that constellation, if you could.
Well, thanks, Sal. So before I start to describe the constellation, as you call it, I think it's prudent that I describe the planet, and that being the School of Advanced Military Studies, because SAMS itself isn't one program. There are three separate programs underneath the SAMS umbrella, and that's changed over time since the initiation of the school in 1983. So I just want to briefly talk about what those programs are, and then I want to talk about the history of the school and how it came to be and how it has evolved over time to meet professional military educational needs of the force. And I say force because at this time, you know, not only do we have all the services represented in the school, we have, it's a multi-component institution. We have the National Guard and the U.S. Army Reserve that participates in this school. We have our international partners that participate in the school. We also have civilians from the Department of the Army civilian side of the house, as well as the interagency Department of State, USAID, and some of our intelligence agencies. So it has grown in scope and scale over time, and I just want to address that first. So the first program we have, and this is the base program, is called the Advanced Military Studies Program, and that's what folks generally call SAMS. That's the way the school started, was with that program. Post-staff college majors and promotable captains. It's our largest program. We graduate 144 students every year from that program, and that is really where we started. And then we grew to develop and implement a seniors program. It was formerly a fellowship, but it's a 2 years program we call the Advanced Strategic Leadership Studies Program. It's a war college equivalent course. It's a little bit smaller. It's a niche educational opportunity. Like you said, Sal, it's probably our least known program. 16 students we produce every year. Again, the same type of mix in terms of the student body. You've got all services represented, as well as the three international partners from the UK, Germany, and Canada. And then we have one interagency student for a total of 16. That's the Advanced Strategic Leadership Studies Program, 2 year program, War College equivalent. It also, you get JPME or Joint Professional Military Education 2 credit with that course. Again, awesome opportunity out there. They do a lot of travel, a lot of field studies, and a lot of focus at the strategic level and strategy implementation and development. That's ASLP. And then the final program, our third program within SAMS, is called the Advanced Strategic Planning and Policy Program, or what is known as ASP3. That program was developed and implemented in 2012. Very unique. It is actually a PhD granting program focusing on developing strategic thinkers and planners for the Army. Army only program. And it has currently 84 officers enrolled. Currently, we bring in and select approximately 11 to 13 each year. These candidates, they're selected by the school, by a board comprised of academics and then senior military officers. They compete for enrollment or acceptance to top-tier universities, fully funded by the Army, PhD programs, generally in the areas of history or political science, some unique niche programs, technology-based programs, social sciences. So they have 3 years to complete their coursework and then complete their dissertation, defend the dissertation, then be awarded their PhD. And then there's a 3-year developmental tour following awarding of the PhD. again, very proud of this program. It's taken off in flight. It takes quite a bit, obviously, to complete a PhD, but we've been very successful with this program. Again, 84 officers in it total. We currently, I think we just received, we just had our 23rd officer receive their PhD out of those 84. And then those officers are working, you know, really at the four-star level in the outer offices, really advising combatant commanders, enterprise-level military officers in decision-making and policy and strategy shaping. So, again, that is our newest program. It's a niche PhD program. It's not developed. It's not designed to produce folks that go to educational institutions. It's about practitioners going back to the field and advising our most senior commanders. So those are the three programs that comprise SAMS, or School Advanced Military Studies. I can talk about each of them in detail. So this is our largest program, is the AMSP program. I'll probably focus a lot of my conversation today on that. Sal, I think it's important to go back in history and determine, you know, why did the Army formulate this specialized school? You know, what was the need that drove this? You have staff colleges, you have the war colleges. Why did the Army go this way and develop a one-year extension of our Command and General Staff College for specially selected officers? Well, back in the early 1980s, it was a colonel. His name was Kuba Vasasaja, M. Sherman, Hungarian descent. He was a research fellow from the Army War College that was detailed to Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, to conduct a study on the staff college. And what he, as he developed his thesis, he focused on the changing complexity of warfare and the need to understand the theory of warfare. He noticed, or his research indicated, that, you know, war was growing increasingly complex, and that the best armies in the world, he took a look at the best armies in the world at that time and how much fenced off time they allocated to their best field grade officers, and how much time they invested on educating their general staff officers. And so we looked at a few countries. So we looked at the British, he looked at the Germans. They invested 100 weeks for their general staff officer educational program. The Russians, 150 weeks. The Israelis, 46 weeks. And then the U.S. Army invested 42 weeks in educating their general staff officers. And his takeaway was, you know, the Army was some of the toughest mission sets in the world. They possessed the most austere school system for their field grade officers. He also noticed that there were several times in history that the Command General Staff College was actually 2 years in length, vice 1 year, which it was then and now. And then he took a look at historically what the 2 year program produced. And then, you know, interestingly enough, during the World War II period, he noticed that every single division and corps commander every division and corps in the U.S. Army in World War II were commanded by, as he called them, Leavenworth men that graduated with a two-year program. And so he, based off this analysis, proposed a second year of studies for select officers. They would receive a broad, deep military education in the science and art of war. Beyond that was provided by the Command and General Staff College. So the desired outcomes of this proposed school would be, you get a better prepared group of staff officers for the demands of general staff work at the division corps and then even higher levels of command. The other outcome is that this effort would seed the Army with a number of officers annually who could provide what he called a leavening influence on the Army by their competence. It would grow incrementally over time. And then the third outcome he was searching for was that you'd have a core group of Army officers that would be educated in the operational art, the level of war, at which tactical successes were connected to strategy in the attainment of policy objectives. And that was a really personal thing for General Vasisasia, because he was a Vietnam War veteran, and he saw how all the tactical victories on the ground, you know, didn't amount to attainment of our strategic objectives. So those were the three desired outcomes from the school. And so the first cohort, they stood up, and it had 13 students in 1980, graduated in 1984. And then over time, in 1989, for example, you brought in the Marine Corps, our first female officers in 1989. The United States Navy brought their first students in 1990. And then in 2006, as the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq were ongoing in the heavy periods, we introduced members of the interagency to help develop those linkages and common language as we work closer and closer in those theaters with the interagency. And we also brought in members of the Department of the Army Civilian Professional Corps. So that is kind of the evolution over time and how we got to where we're at today, based on a vision of a few really innovative officers that saw a need to, you know, develop, provide a little bit more development of our officer before we sent them back into the field to their key developmental opportunities. So 13 students in 1984. The AMSP program now is 144, so it's been expanded rapidly and in many numbers. We've grown both in the number and quality of the faculty we have on board, the curriculum. I would say the fundamentals of the curriculum has remained in place, but the curriculum has also evolved over time. It's kind of a proven methodology. We have the benefit of having very, very talented PhDs, which teach in tandem with second-year colonels and lieutenant colonels, so that you have that academic and that practitioner working with 16 students in each seminar in the adult learning model to really give them a quality education. So I'm going to pause at that point, but I thought it was important to kind of describe how we've gotten to this point in the history of the school, and describe that it's not just one program. There are three very specialized programs within the SAMS umbrella. And I'll pause.
Well, I'm General Umpty Scrunch, and I'm out there looking for my staff. And when I get an officer who has come through the AMSP, what do I get? What am I looking for? What do I get that helps me do my job?
So we have an allocation plan that's developed by Headquarters Department of the Army, G357. So we have a required number of graduates we must send to the field to serve at the division level, the corps level, or the Army Service Component Command level. So the division, for example, will receive four graduates. The corps headquarters will receive five graduates. And so what should they expect? Well, they should expect really high quality leaders and teammates. You know, they're not individuals. They know and they are trained here to work as a team who can coach, collaborate, and train other staff members effectively. You can expect them to be very effective critical thinkers, yet creative thinkers. They are to be grounded in operational theory, not only Army doctrine, but joint doctrine, and also history. They should be able to identify problems and then be able to propose viable solutions to those problems. And they should be able to communicate to a variety of audiences, both verbally, graphically, and in writing. And that's one thing, you know, I tell candidates as they interview. They're all volunteers, and we interview every single one of them, as well as they submit a very detailed application packet. But the one thing I can promise them, other than death and taxes, is they're going to be a better briefer, a better writer, and have a much broader understanding of history than they were when they enrolled. The third thing is they're going to be physically tough. They're going to be mentally tough. We know this isn't the Pocket Protector Brigade. You know, these aren't just nerds. These are warriors. So we expect to have Great bearing. And we expect them to be able to hold up under the duress of those planning jobs. And Sal, I know we talked earlier about you serving on some of those high-performing staffs. It takes a toll on folks who aren't not only intellectually sharp, but they've got to be physically resilient, and so they've got to be physically and mentally tough. And then the fourth thing is, and we espouse this, is we expect them to be humble professionals. They're not smarter than anybody else because they had this education opportunity. They're not better than anybody else. They should be humble by this experience and knowing that, and I know I felt this as a student, every day I left the schoolhouse, I felt like I knew less than when I entered the doorway. And I think, you know, this really rigorous opportunity tends to humble even some of the folks with the top line egos. And then, of course, going to school every day with 15 other seminar mates who, quite frankly, are the best of the best within their field, and learning from them and that seminar dynamic. I always, when I talk to students, I said, you know what, you'd rather die than fail or look poorly among your seminar. You're going to invest so that you've done the work, because they'll know when you don't do the work. And then in terms of your contribution to the learning environment, you know, that's something that the seminar demands of one another, and they police one another. And I think that driver, that environment, those highly motivated, intellectually curious young officers, that's what makes the experience special. It really is. And we invest a lot in picking the right students for the course, but when you get them in that seminar environment, you know, that they got the PhD that's accomplished in their field, and you got that practitioner colonel who successfully commanded at the 05 level and generally is either selected for the 06 level command or is going to be, you know, they kind of facilitate, but the learning really takes it up a notch with a seminar dynamic. And so, but we want them to be humble, and I think it is a humbling experience. So those are the outcomes that we expect from our graduates, both in the AMSP and ASLSP program, and those are the types of leaders that the division and corps commanders expect to see on the ground. And, of course, the network that we have out there, right now you've got decades of SAMS graduates out there at echelon, doing the heavy lifting on many, many staffs, from the combatant command, from the joint staff, even in the NSC right now, all the way down to the division level. I always said if I ever got in trouble, I could pick up the phone. It doesn't matter what headquarters you point me towards. I can get a SAMS graduate on the telephone within seconds and understand. They can understand what I'm conveying, and I can understand what they're conveying. We can get things done because of that network, very tightly knit network, that's evolved over the course of decades now. So we're very proud of that as well.
One of the reasons I was really happy to have you on here is I smiled a couple of times as you were explaining things. I went, yep, that's exactly what it is. Because everybody likes to talk tactics. Everybody wants to be a tactician. And those that are confused by too many acronyms, they like to talk big picture, big pixels on the strategic level. But there's that operational middle, that operational part right there in the middle. I think that the terminology used from the guy who started SAM was tactical action connected to strategic objectives. And my introduction to SAMs was when I was on General McKernan's staff in Kabul in 08-09. He put out a call like, I need some SAMS graduates here right now. And you could see why, because there he was at they used a rather interesting non-doctrinal term, at least that I knew of, called in-theater operational. But they were working on the shape here, shape, clear, hold, build strategy that he brought to the table with him. And when he would sit around with his staff, half of them would be non-US, and the other half that was US, he'd be lucky if half of them are Army. So he needed somebody that spoke his language and could better communicate his desires, his intents into a briefing and into a plan that he could move along at a faster pace. And when I kind of was disappointed at one point, and I'm going to put put the Navy on report here a bit. I wanted to talk to you about the fact that, you know, the opportunity to build this echelon of knowledge that you have at SAMS, and you're right, there is a certain language and an understanding where, you know, if they went there, they speak the language and communicate quickly, you have a similar reference point. And in the 2018 class of 158, from the report that I saw, you had 10 Air Force, 4 Marine Corps, 14 international, but absolutely zero U.S. Navy types. However, as we both know, when you get in the operational and higher level staffs, you have lots of Navy guys going around. And so we don't have even a little bit of seed corn of understanding of exactly some of the perspectives our ground counterparts may have that came from SAMS. You talk for a little bit from your perspective, what you think this not isolated, we've talked about it on previous episodes of MidRats up to and including the Undersecretary of the Navy, the difficulty the Navy has in even moving beyond a token participation of what really are world-class institutions in the military profession.
Yes, Sal, a great question. So it's not just the Navy, I believe. I think there's some, although I will talk about my desire to get more Navy officers in the program, because I think, again, you described, and I described earlier, some of the composition of the seminar, which is really the learning environment. And we pride ourselves, every seminar, for example, has a broad mixture. We mix the seminars up so that there is an Air Force officer, there is a Marine, there's one or two international officers, there's a DA civilian or interagency civilian, there's another person from a reserve or guard component. So, you know, that is that cauldron, right? That's the brew of talent that really ups our game and the discussion and the dialogue, because those perspectives are brought into the classroom and they're really irreplaceable component of how we teach and how we educate. Our officers from the Navy are just absolutely fantastic when we can get them here. However, I think there's, and this exists in many of the services, but maybe more so now in the Navy, is there's a magnetic pull, I believe, or I observe, to the field and value on field experience. And if we pull you from the field and you're going back to the schoolhouse, well, that's just taking a knee, right? That's just taking a break. You're on sports scholarship. You're having family time. Well, I can tell you this, you know, SAMS, you're not taking a knee at SAMS. Yes, you're home at night spending time with your family, but you are literally immersed every single day in your studies. And if you're not studying for class, you're writing your thesis or your monograph, or you're conducting research for that, or you're getting ready to participate in one of our five, you know, very intense exercises in our exercise program, or you're getting ready to participate on a theater staff ride where you're actually traveling across this part of the country and learning about Grant's campaigns and how he conducted, you know, his campaigns in the Civil War. So there, it's a difficult, rigorous year. They're going to earn that master's degree at the end of the school year. They're going to earn it. But there's a magnetic pull, and I've seen it with the Army as well, where there are commanders out there and other entities that put more value on experience in the field by spending time in our PME institutions. And I think it's short-sighted. I think I see transformation of our officers when they enter the schoolhouse. I mean, they are not the same people when they leave. Just their exposure to the material, the repetitions and sets they have at writing and briefing. You know, you got an introvert that all of a sudden becomes just a fantastic briefer, fantastic communicator. You know, we take these officers to a new level of performance, and we work them very hard. And their experience is important to bring into the school. But I think, you know, there's a group thought out there that, hey, time in school is probably not as valuable as time on the job. And until you get past that and learn that, you know, that's not long ball thinking. It's very short-sighted. And quite frankly, you know, those officers who don't invest in this educational opportunity are probably going to culminate at some point a little bit earlier. And, you know, we want to take that potential and really, you know, juice that potential and get that out of them and help those students realize their potential. But they can't do it if they're not availed of the opportunity. And I think it's, you know, it's a cultural issue, I believe. I don't know what you think, Sal.
Well, it's an interesting problem for the Navy because I think, as you already said, when you're a lieutenant commander slash major or a commander, a very young commander, you're trying to get your command qual. You're trying to become, I mean, that may be a senior department head, maybe an XO on a ship, and those are the billets that you have to have. And if you take a year off, that may drop you out of and this is the short-sightedness you're pointing out, may drop you out of the competitive category you were in if you don't move on to that next level. And I guess one of the differences is that I see is that I know my father-in-law was an Army officer, my dad was an Air Force officer, the Command and General Staff School, and the screening process for that is the way the Army selects its up-and-coming officers. And I don't know that we do the same thing other than at a department head level, say, for a shipboard command in the Navy that you all do. Is that part of the process, a cultural difference between these services that you've identified and that we need to look at in the Navy?
Well, I could say this. To those who think – because, you know, there's a career timeline for every service, right? And there are certain positions – and experiences that officers must have as they progress to stay promotable or to stay on track, glad path. For example, an Army officer, you know, they're coming earlier and earlier to Command General Staff School now. They're coming as captain promotables. They're pinning on major there, and then they're coming over to SAMS for that second year if they're selected. Upon graduation, just so the audience understands, you know, the typical active Army officer is going to again, serve a utilization tour. So you, as part of the deal here for attending SAMS, you've got a one-year utilization assignment in a planned, a coded billet, right, that the Department of the Army establishes in conjunction with the combatant commands all the way down. So there are billets we must fill. Graduates, they must complete a one-year utilization tour, and then they go to what we call key developmental assignments, such as you described, Eagle, which is they've got to serve essentially 24 months either as an operations officer, then an executive officer, or an operations officer, then a brigade-level operations officer. So they have those 24 months of job time or evaluation time they have to get under their belt as well. So, but the cost is they've got to do that utilization tour as well. So there's some risk actually in attending SAMS. You've got to watch that timeline carefully. Now, for those in the field who say, hey, you know, don't bother with it, just get to the field, get your key developmental time under your belt as an Army officer, you know, it may hurt you. Well, we've got the statistics now from our Human Resources Command to show that, for example, in the 2019 command Lieutenant Colonel 05 level command select list for our basic branches in 2019, the overall selection rate for officers for battalion command was 32%. If you were a SAMS or AMSP graduate, the selection rate was 58%. Right. So our message to candidates that are looking to compete to attend SAMS is, hey, you know, I can't promise you it's gonna you know, get you promoted, get you selected, but what we're seeing now is it doesn't hurt you. And oh, by the way, I attribute that 58% rate at officers that are going out until they graduate, they go to very difficult jobs in that first year, serving, you know, having direct interface with general officers from the 2-3 star level, sometimes 4-star, and they're doing very well in those jobs. And then they're kind of being managed, you know, the talent management, they're being managed more carefully. And then they've got a bunch of tools that they bring to the table in their key developmental assignments, and they're just operating a higher RPM rate, and that education is really giving them an advantage. So we think, although you know it does kind of alter your timeline, we think it's a huge benefit to walk away with this education. So you can have your cake and eat it too. You can do those jobs you must have to do to complete your progression, but you're also going to avail yourself of this opportunity. And so I would say, and I think, you know, our military services kind of need to look at that timeline to invest in their people. Because if you're not going to invest in your people, you can invest in things all day long. The intellectual has to lead the physical. And we even do this thing now, this was new upon my arrival that I discovered they implemented, which I think is fantastic, which is for folks that, let's say, either went right to the field from the staff college or, you know, at the time they hadn't made up their mind and they just went on to their follow-on assignment out of the staff college into their key developmental assignments. Well, we allow them, we call it our field select option, which is officers who are in the field can apply, as long as you're still a major, can apply and come back to school and attend AMSP on the backside. So, and in doing so, for us, we love it because they bring all that currency and recent experience in the field back into the seminar room, which helps, again, leaven and help us coach up those who are getting ready to depart and go back to the field. So, again, I think it's about availing options for officers. I think it's about building in time so that they're not trapped by that, you know, that cycle, which annuls their opportunity to get education. I think we need to have a large look at that. I know the Army and our Talent Management Task Force is looking at this as well to make sure that they have not only is the time there, but there are options available for officers to pursue. You know, not only am I a graduate of AMSP, and it changed my life because I went straight to the field in Germany with the 1st Infantry Division and then, you know, helped them deploy into Iraq. And that, you know, gosh, I don't think I could have cut it without the education that I had. I was very tactically competent, but I was kind of an introvert, and I loved history and theory, but I hadn't read nearly as much as I thought I did. So I just took all that knowledge, went straight into a crucible job, and you know, thankfully I had some partners who really assisted me. And but that education was vital in my development and my ability to succeed at further levels. And I think we have to be able to invest in our field grade officers, and you know, other things, you know, for example, you know, I didn't go to the war college. The Army sent me on a senior service college fellowship to the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. I mean, come on now. I'm a graduate of a public school system in Massachusetts, and they allowed me to go to MIT and be rub elbows with some of our smartest theorists in the country. I mean, come on. And then later, after I got out of a command of a joint task force, 06 level joint task force, the Army sent me to Harvard University. Are you kidding me? I mean, I could have never availed myself of those opportunities in kind of a normal track, right? But there I am, you know, studying with legends such as Joe Nye and Stephen Wald. I mean, it's amazing the opportunities the Army's provided me as, you know, kind of your average bear. So I think services need to take a hard look at our PME, our cycles and our progressions, because the opportunities are out there. This PhD program, for example, it's, you know, we're still in the nascent stages of that, but we're seeing now what the possible is, because now, as we get more PhD complete officers in the field, their contributions are measurable, you know, for these combatant commanders that are just wrestling with some really wicked problems out there. So that's I think the Army's got, you know, has really done a good job of opening up the aperture and sending a signal that, you know, education is important. you know, we're all going to go back into the field at some point and, you know, pay our dues. But, you know, wouldn't you want to enter the field with a few more tools in your kit bag? And I think that's what SAMS does for the average officer.
Yeah, I'm not sure how a good boy from Massachusetts who went to MIT and Harvard avoids having that Massachusetts accent. You've been in Kansas long enough, you got that nice, neutral, Midwestern accent. So the Army's helped you do that, if nothing else.
I married a North Carolina girl, my friend, and that'll do it to you.
Well, you're living right.
Thank you, sir.
So their barbecue leaves something to be desired, but we'll talk about food some other time. probably not unrelated to my previous question, is this. As I was reading up on SAMS, it came to mind a big argument we have in the Navy is a technical versus a liberal arts education. As a matter of fact, I had a guest post over my home blog on Monday by Brian McGrath talking about history majors versus math majors and how they look at problems. And one thing that I saw over and over again in the discussions about SAMS and also some of the reports from people who have attended SAMS and have written about their experience is that emphasis on history. Talk a little bit about why that is such an important focus and why having a diverse and in-depth view of history while studying modern military challenges, what that connection and why that's important.
Right. And I would say, you know, there's been that, you know, ongoing historical debate on, you know, are we trying to train or are we trying to educate? Right. And then I think the answer is, you know, you train for certainty, right. And you educate for uncertainty. And, you know, There just seems to be, I think, over time, you know, the kind of that wrestling match of where that sweet spot should be. Because there's no doubt there's a need for technical experts out there. I mean, I don't care what service you're in. I mean, if you're going to be working on a jet engine, I mean, of course you're going to want a technician, the best technician you can have working on that piece of gear. But you've got to have folks who understand history and understand what it means and how it should translate. So, you know, we have this this course called Evolutions of. We have seven courses, for example, in the AMSP program. So, we have this course called Evolution of Operational Art. And what we do is we take a look at select campaigns and major operations, shorter campaigns. And so we use Evolutions of Operational Art as a lens through which to understand and evaluate the practice of what is today what we call operational art through the examination of past actions and how the commanders in history have interpreted, negotiated, and translated policy into strategy and plans, and then how they executed those plans in the battlefield to achieve strategic ends or not. And really the course is not about lessons learned. It's about avoiding repetition, and it's not about avoiding repetition in the past, and it's not about identifying winners or losers. You see a lot, I think, on social media, and everybody's hung up on identifying winners or losers, but it's really about conditioning your mind to think broadly, deeply, and most importantly, to be thinking about the longer term, right? And it's learning to appreciate focus, detail, and specificity as you step back, perceive, and understand broad rhythms, right, and patterns, and understand more clearly the roles of ambiguity, complexity, risk, and chance in war. So that's kind of how we approach history and the use of history in our course. And excuse me, it's a rigorous course, and you're talking, you know, I think as you look at it holistically. You know, I've heard it coined, you know, the book of the nightclub here at SAMS. But, you know, the average student in AMSP is going to read about 69 books, about 155 articles. They're going to review about 38 historical cases or campaigns. Then they've got doctrinal readings as well. So they've got about 55 doctrinal readings that they've got to accomplish. We've amped up our writing requirements. So they do about 13 long papers, and then actually they do a monograph, which is about 40 pages or more, publishable quality with a thesis. And then they've got 6 graded oral and graphic presentations. And that's just the baseline curriculum. On top of the board work and the class participation or class contribution assessments we make of the students. So they carry a pretty heavy rucksack, and a lot of that is historically based. Over.
Yeah, when these folks are working through this program and they're examining these past campaigns or whatever level that they're looking at, are they going through and working through situations where they get the commander's intent and then have to follow that down through what his options are and give it a commander's estimate of situation and all that sort of thing? Is it that kind of process, or is it studying these things, walking in the footsteps, and just seeing how complicated things really were for those people in the past?
Yeah, thanks, Eagle. So the answer to the first part of your question is yes. And so we've got a very robust exercise program. We've got 5 kind of large-scale exercises that apply Army or joint planning doctrine with them. Generally, they're oriented at the division or corps or JTF level. We even have the Marine Corps MAGTAF staff training program that comes in for one of those exercises and teaches us about how to employ the MAGTAF, and we actually run a scenario where they have to plan an operation with that MAGTAF. So the exercises orient on large-scale combat ops and campaign planning or design, and that's really where they take all the tools they learn in the classroom, they kind of lay them on the table. We break all the students down into operational planning teams, or what we call OPTs. Everybody's assigned a staff role, and then they kind of get ambiguous problem sets and some material from our scenario and exercise developers, and they kind of have to sort through it from soup to nuts. And they can use – we allow them to use various – methods. They can use the joint operational planning process. They can use the military decision-making process that we teach in the Army. They can use McPP from the Marine Corps planning process. They can use design methodology. They can take all those things they learn in the course, have a problem set to develop options for. We bring in general officers and flag officers and other academics to play roles of commanders or chiefs of staff, or advisors. We bring them into the fray when we do these exercises, and we really work them out. So to answer your question, yes, they have those opportunities to translate kind of the book learning, so to speak, into practical application that they're going to have to utilize from day one when they sign into that unit upon graduation. We also realize that, you know, it's critically important that, you know, a student who – they graduate, they can't survive that first year of utilization as a planner. Really, if they can't do well there, they won't have an opportunity to continue on and be that agent of change or that influencer that we want them to be. So we've got to set them up for success in that first utilization tour immediately upon graduation. So we really work repetitions and sets to make sure that as a member of whether they be a lead of an operational planning team or another staff member, that they are going to not only contribute but excel and be able to lead a staff of folks that may not have the educational background experience they do. Over.
We did, as we discussed earlier, you have a bunch of international students there, and
yeah,
I assume that give you an opportunity not just to talk to them about their institutional cultures and view and their perspectives on a lot of the challenges that y'all look at, but have you also given you a chance to look at some of our allied and partner nations, how they educate or formulate the professional development of their officers that you find interesting and that we might not have the equivalent of on our end?
Well, I will say this. So let's see. I think we had eight countries represented in the majors program, three represented in the seniors program. And when I started my comments that the brand is established and recognized, I think that the SAMS brand is hugely respected and sought after by several countries who really fight to get their way into the school. So we don't have a quota on what nation gets to attend SAMS or gets to compete, have their candidates compete for SAMS. So I can say that there are several of our partners that they send their best and brightest here. And in many ways, they, particularly in the ranking, when we bring them in and test them all and we evaluate them all on an order of merit list before we make selection, you know, traditionally the international partner officers are in many ways stronger than a lot of the American officers and their skill sets and how they rank out in our evaluation system. So in particular, you know, I've got to say that the Germans, the Canadians, the British Army, the Australians, every single year for you know, a decade or two decades, you know, they send the best and brightest from their armies. And over time, we've seen phenomenal officers, for example, in this upcoming cohort, you know, Brazil, France, Italy, Jordan, Korea, Lebanon. I mean, they are just outstanding officers, and not just in their home militaries, but they rank among the best of anybody who attends the staff college across the street at Fort Leavenworth. So they are automatically leaders just because of who they are and their experience among each seminar, and they do add incredible value. If you want to, and we have to understand, you know, some of our Army officers, generally they're newly promoted majors or senior captains, and they've got a lot of tactical experience, and generally they have anywhere from one to three deployments somewhere around the globe. But a lot of these international partner officers have been to some far-reaching destinations, some very interesting places, and then they operate. A lot of them have a much deeper understanding of, for example, how NATO operates, and generally, for example, using that example, our majors, they don't know a lot about NATO, and all you've got to do is bring a German officer in or a British officer, or et cetera, and they'll lay it out, soup to nuts, on how NATO operates and how it organizes and what are the guidelines and what is the approach and what are the contributions. And so it's something like that, that, you know, these officers from our partner nations just contribute that, you know, our American students, you know, they benefit from that, but they just don't have that type of background. But I can say that, you know, and the countries that are represented, they reflect maybe, you know, a third of the other nations that sent up incredible candidates that tried to apply and compete. But we're very proud of our – and that network, you know, because they become – there's such a tight, cohesive group of students that graduate. You know, those relationships follow throughout the year. So we've seen, for example, general officers or officers get promoted to general officer in Canada that are products of the SAMS program, and in other countries as well. So that network over time, it's just – and it doesn't matter what nation they're from or even what languages they're speaking, you know, it's powerful, and it's much bigger than the United States. It's very broad. And you talk about interoperability, what? And that's some, you know, built-in, baked-in interoperability right there, is to have, you know, SAMS graduates talking to each other, wearing different uniforms in different countries. That's pretty powerful. And we're starting to see that now with the numbers we're generating each and every year. Over.
Yeah, I'm sitting here thinking of a quote that Admiral King during World War II said, something like, I don't know what the hell this logistics that Marshall is always talking about is, but I want some of it. And I'm thinking, right, we need to get Navy leadership thinking, I don't know what the hell this SAMS is, but it sounds like something, right, that they need to be getting on top of. What is the outreach program you guys have?
So the outreach program, we spend a lot, and again, to clarify, AMSP, we select and we conduct our own selection board within the school. For the ASLSP senior program, that is a centralized board that the Department of the Army conducts. And then for ASP 3 PhD program, we also conduct a local board and select those students. But for AMSP, the largest program in terms of our outreach, you know, we travel every fall. We go to all the staff colleges, and we brief all the staff colleges. You know, I stand up there. I went to Maxwell, you know, this fall, for example, stood in front of all their students and laid out with my director for academics the entire – and they look at SAMS initially kind of with a – you know, they're critical thinkers, and, you know, they sit there with a little doubt – you know, in their eyes. And then by the time you're done, when you kind of lay out that really, you know, I could honestly lay out, I could have against the wall, stand up students in civilian clothes. It would be difficult to pick out who's the Air Force officer, who's the, you know, UK officer, who's the Army reservist, because they really all start, they think and have, by the time they're done, they kind of have that similar background, that similar language. And it's far less parochial once we're in the schoolhouse. So, and everybody takes something away. I'm constantly astounded by the feedback I get from the other service representatives about how positive the experience was. But we do go to all the staff colleges and interface with them. We'll talk to anybody. We interface a lot with the National Guard, Office of Army Reserve. The internationals, we have a Department of State representative here at the Command General Staff College who kind of filters and kind of provides administrative oversight of the international students who are going to compete. And then you've got an interagency representative at the college as well who is a conduit for us to pull in, you know, high level talent from Department of State, USAID, DIA, CIA, institutions like that. So recently in my tenure, you know, we started up, we didn't have a great social media presence. So we started up our Twitter account. I hope everybody will get out there and follow @US_SAMS. Because we just weren't connecting with a broader population. So we got the SAMS Twitter page up and running. We hope to get YouTube up and running and posting a lot of videos there. But outreach, you know, you could say, hey, it's competitive. Let them come to you. We put out through the Army personnel system what we call military personnel messages. And we share them through the other services, but instead of relying on kind of the standard personnel message traffic, we are trying to find unique ways to get out there and recruit and get the word out so that we have a broad pool to bring in to select from. Now, this year we had the most applicants or candidates from any year to date, almost 500 applied to AMSP, and those 500 had to be signed off on by a supervisor, a first line supervisor. You know, we're very happy that we had such a large pool to draw upon. So the word's getting out, you know, the representation that, you know, that Sal put out there, I mean, these officers stand out there in the field, and And particularly in the, what it was interesting in the Air Force and the Marine Corps, you know, they actually go out and they aggressively recruit amongst the services. And so, as much as I think, you know, hey, we may not be doing a great job of getting the word out, the word is getting out. And we do cooperative endeavors with both SAS, the School of Advanced Air Power Studies at Maxwell, and SAW, the Marine Corps equivalent of Quantico, and JAWS down there in Norfolk, Virginia. So we are talking to the other specialty schools as well, because they have Army officers that compete for their schools, and we have their services officers competing for ours. So we cross-talk a lot and try to vector the right candidate for the right school, if that makes sense. Over.
Sure does. And Kirk, this has been a great hour. Really appreciate you taking time today for the discussion. And I understand you'll be turning things over here pretty soon. What's next for you?
Well, I'm going to hang up the Spurs, I believe. I think it's about that time. I'm coming up on the 3-decade mark of service. And I never thought in a million years I would be allow the opportunity to come back to an institution that really, in my opinion, transformed who I am, not only as an officer, but as a person. So it was a real gift to come back and contribute and continue the legacy of excellence that SAMS is known for. And it's been an absolute joy being part of the educational development of our mid-grade officers. So to give back to this institution has been probably one of the biggest gifts I've ever received.
Well, I wish you luck in the transition. I did it myself about a decade ago, though I still have the haircut. It turned out all right.
No, I mean, to hear, to see what you're doing out there, Sal, and to follow some of your initiatives and your outreach and your social media postures. I learn something every day from folks like you, and so I hope that you and Eagle continue to drive on with your mission, and to get folks like myself out there to get the word out. In this day and age, there's no reason not to be able to take advantage of these venues. But I want to thank you guys for your service, and this has been a real privilege. And I thank you, for really taking the time to hear about this program, because I do think it changes lives and it's making a difference out there. And at the end of the day, as I tell the students, you know, you got to remember that every order you publish, every operation you plan, you've got to keep in the forefront of your mind that's America's sons and daughters. They have to go out the gate and execute that mission, or go off the aircraft deck, or step forward, move out on those vessels. And it's really important business that, again, that the intellectual leads the physical, and we need our best and brightest out there so that we are fulfilling the nation's call and achieving our strategic objectives. And the only way we're going to do that is if we invest in our people. And that's why I'm so passionate about SAMS. And I've loved it. And I love the Army. I love serving the nation. And I love talking to professionals like yourselves.
Well, that's awesome. Amen. Thank you very much for your service and for the kind words. And Godspeed you on your next decisions.
Well, thanks, guys. Appreciate it. And have a great rest of the show. I'm going to hang up and tune in.
Well, great. And thank you very much again. And we'll see what we can do to get the Navy to get off the ball and send some folks to what really is a great professional institution. And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of Mid-Wraps. We're going to have a Father's Day best of next weekend. But following that, on the 23rd of June, we're going to have a returning guest, Commander B.J. Armstrong, to discuss his book, Small Boats and Daring Men. And we'll end up June, on 30 June, another returning guest, Lieutenant Jack McCain, who has just come back from a deployment to Afghanistan, helping to train the ANSF helicopter pilots on the Black Hawk helicopter. So please tune in. And until then, hope everybody has a great Navy and Army day. Cheers.
Maloney. different.